making Jacksonville a more resilient city. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we speak with Councilwoman Randy DeFore about her new leadership of the city's Resiliency Committee. What are your questions about resiliency, climate change, sea level rise here in Florida? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, chances are you're planning to vote by mail this primary. Just how accessible are those mail-in ballots? That's coming up. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Statewide, the Department of Health reports an increase of over 4,100 cases of COVID overnight. The death toll in the state stands at 8,277, with 318 deaths from coronavirus in our area. Now, amidst the ongoing toll of the pandemic, there is other news to discuss. Ice sheets are melting in the Arctic, making headlines around the world this week. A new study says flooding from rising seas could eventually cost the planet $14 trillion to mitigate. Concerns about the effects of climate change are especially acute here in Florida, of course, with our thousands of miles of coastline. And it's no surprise to people in older neighborhoods that are eroding infrastructure struggles even during a routine storm. Just last night in Riverside, residents were treated to flooded streets, unable to handle water runoff. Now, District 14 Councilmember Randy DeFore chairs Jacksonville's new Special Committee on Resiliency, and that group has been tasked with preparing this city for the effects of sea level rise and flooding related to climate change. Councilmember DeFore is on the line right now, and it's good to have you on the show. Good morning.
Thank you, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And good morning to you. What are your questions about resiliency for Northeast Florida? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Let me begin by asking you about the flooding actually in your neck of the woods, Councilwoman. Yeah. In Riverside, people sharing lots of pictures and videos on social media overnight. This was just a regular rainstorm, but the flooding shows how our infrastructure in this city is already struggling to deal with water runoff, even during a run-of-the-mill weather event. And so as you chair this Committee on Resiliency, part of that involves planning for the future and shoring up some shaky infrastructure. How do you see the city addressing this problem?
Well, we're working at it from two points of entry, if you will. One is, how do we develop going forward? And the second one is, what do we do with the development that exists today? And it's a huge issue. I mean, you're right. Last night is a great example for my district. I was receiving calls, just urgent calls, and it got the police involved because we couldn't get people off. Literally, we're stuck on the overpass on Edgewood. So it's an issue that we have to address immediately.
How do you see the committee planning for budget around this? It boggles the mind to think of the cost. Right. Of really doing what is needed to mitigate against flooding that we know is coming in future decades. Have you done some studying of the cost that will accrue to Jacksonville? As I said, a study that just made headlines this week shows that climate change around the world, mitigating against it, is expected to cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $14 trillion.
Right.
And so how do we pay for what we're going to need to do?
Well, that's a real issue. What they've done in Miami and Monroe County is they worked with, actually Congress charged the Corps of Engineers to do a plan, and the Miami and those counties sponsored it, and they came up with these amazing, incredible plans, but they're very expensive. And for Miami alone, it's a $4.6 billion plan. Now, the good news for Miami is now that the federal government is involved, the federal government will participate in probably 50% of any of those costs. So that's the kind of thing we need to be thinking about and moving forward in Jacksonville, and that's not where we have been today.
And so how do you hope that this resiliency committee will perhaps change the conversation and priorities in this community? Because certainly you've heard from your constituents that they are increasingly concerned about this issue.
I think by putting in the forefront, I mean, by saying this is an absolute necessity, we have to address it. And unfortunately, there's a water bill as we speak on the floor in D.C. that we should be part of. But as you know, government works slower than I would like. I'm from the private sector. I'm trying to move people in that direction so we can get on, if we can, get part of federal funding to address this. But that's what it's going to take. It's going to take a targeted focus on this issue, not just in the state level, but at the federal level and the local level.
And you were recently quoted about the approval of the city council, $75 million in funding for ongoing dredging of the St. John's River to accommodate larger ships coming in from Jacksport. Environmental groups sued to stop that. They say the damage being done by the deepening project could outweigh any economic gains. It will increase salinity in the river, increase the chances of flooding, the kind of flooding that we all lived through in the wake of Hurricane Irma. You've said you haven't given up on mitigation.
I have not given up on mitigation. That's why I worked with and found out about the impact that water bill that's on the floor. I believe what happened in that situation. First of all, we're halfway through the dredging today. So, mm-hmm. To me, that the horse is out of the barn. And so, what do we do about it? That's the question. I found out that I believe we left a lot of mitigation dollars on the table because we were so focused on the Rodman Dam and trying to remove the Rodman Dam. Well, that would have been great, but that's in someone else's county. And, you know, it's hard to get anything done in another person's county. So I think we should have been focused on mitigation dollars here. I'm not giving up. I have the Corps, and both the Corps and the port have given me their word that they will continue to work with me with mitigation dollars.
Okay. Has the committee done an estimate of the amount of money Jacksonville should be planning for in the coming couple of decades to protect itself against what we know is coming? Rising seas, more intense storms, which will bring more flooding, including inland flooding, not just coastal flooding.
Well, that's why we're meeting. That's what we're doing. We're bringing the community in. I mean, this is not just the city council. This is very much a community-driven committee, and we've broken it down to three different subcommittees. We have the environmental planning subcommittee. We have the infrastructure subcommittee, and then we have the community education subcommittee. And those are being led by, in the case of infrastructure, Garrett Dennis. In the case of education, community outreach, Joyce Morgan and Michael Boylan. And then environmental, we have Brooks Andrews. So they're all working on these issues. And we're going to bring it all together at the end and have an action plan. And at that point, we will have to bring engineers and other people to give an estimate of what this is going to cost. But I will tell you, what I see occurring at the end of this process is probably addressing more of the low-hanging fruit in terms of the greater, which is what I think you're asking, the greater goal and plan as Jacksonville as a whole going forward. I really believe that we're going to have to get the Corps involved and get and help with federal funding.
Federal funding. All right.
Yes.
Let's go to some calls now for Councilmember Randy DeFore. She chairs the City Council's new Resiliency Committee. What are your questions about this? Increasingly, Floridians are urgently demanding that their representatives locally, at the statewide level and at the federal level, respond with more speed and urgency to these issues. Of course, climate change is driving rising seas, melting ice sheets, rising temperatures. Florida, the most vulnerable state in the nation to the effects of climate change. So let's go to some of your thoughts right now. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Janet is in Avondale. Hi, Janet. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to complain, really, about the corner of Shirley and Herschel, who I have called the city drainage for years, asking them to fix this problem. I was literally on lakefront property yesterday, and water all the way around my house completely, and I'm in the middle of the block. Now, this is going on years and years and years, and I've asked them to address this drain, and they have not. Those are basic things that the city council, I went to Jim Love and I asked him years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, please fix this problem. They said that it was fine. It was just high tide. Well, yesterday it was a low tide, and it's been every time it rains, it floods. Mm-hmm. So it's a serious problem. And those are the things that the drainage system can be fixed, and I'd like that to be addressed. Can you address that?
Absolutely. Is it Janet? I want to make sure I got your name correct.
Janet,
absolutely.
Yes.
And thank you, Janet, and I thank you for your call, and we will get on that today. What I'm finding out is that in some areas, we're seeing the river come up through the drainage system. It doesn't even have to take a rain. And
right.
So if it's high river, you know, literally, it will go up through the drainage system, up onto the street.
Yeah.
So we're trying to get a system in place where the drainage will only go one way. And we're going to do that into Stockton Street and some others in Riverside. And I certainly will get your, we'll put yours on the list, Shirley and Herschel, I wrote it down, to address.
Yeah. After Hurricane Irma, the historic neighborhoods along the river saw the brunt of flooding, and we saw just how vulnerable our infrastructure and drainage systems are, San Marco, Riverside in particular. That said, communities in other parts of town that have historically been woefully underserved don't even have sidewalks and adequate sewage. These are poorer communities, primarily, but not always, African-American communities. They get walloped after every hurricane and storm, and they are especially vulnerable. So, Council Member DeFour, is the Resiliency Committee going to get serious about this notion of climate justice, realizing that the poorest and most vulnerable communities are most at risk for the long-term impacts of climate change?
Well, we have the Social Justice Committee going on right now. I'm also on that committee. And so what I thought would happen is that we bring that information from the Resiliency Committee to the Social Justice Committee. The Resiliency Committee really is focused on addressing the health of the coastline and the St. John's River system and the tributaries and the wetlands and all that, and prioritizing those issues. But I agree with you. We need to also address those that they're economically depressed areas, and we're going to give that information to the social justice area so that they can also address that.
And as you said, you see the city in the future appealing to the feds for funding to mitigate these issues, because, I mean, let's face it, this is a city that was reluctant to even do a slight millage increase to raise property taxes to pay for some basic needs. Just a week or two ago, your colleagues voted that idea down. But we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars over time to shore up this city. I mean, the New York Times did a study last year that showed Jacksonville, Florida would be the most expensive city in America to seawall, because we have more miles of coastline, both at the ocean and inland with the river and all its tributaries, than any mm-hmm. other American city. So I
don't think hardening's the, you know, my personal belief is I don't think hardening's the way. I mean, some areas we have to do hardening, seawalls, but in other areas we really need to be thinking of the living, you know, living coastline mm-hmm. so that we start using our environment. That's why this subcommittee is so important on environment, using our environment, buying back wetlands to address this issue. And I think it can be done. I really do. But I think it's more than $100 million. I think we're probably going to be in the billion-dollar range. It's just my own personal belief. If you look at Miami and they're 4.6, I don't think that's probably too far off. And so you're absolutely right. It's going to be incredibly expensive. And we need to have a plan.
$1 billion to mitigate this city. And what about the hiring of a chief resiliency officer for Jacksonville, which I know that's become
that
a recent priority?
Right. That's in the plan. That's in the budget. And that will happen this year.
This year. All right. Let's go to a few more calls for Randy DeFour, 549-2937 to join us. Tracy down in Mandarin. Hi, Tracy.
Good morning. Good morning. We live in Mandarin. And I tell you, it's when it rained like last night for last 25 years, three things are always there. Mandarin Road looks like a lake. I don't know, it comes back from the river to us, or then the trees fall, then the electricity goes off. This is a cycle for last 25 years. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I don't know if 25 years is not fixed. You think it will be another 25 years before we look something? And I don't know what's the solution. This is horrible from the time we have moved to Mandarin. Feel like moving out from there.
Tracy, sorry to hear that. And, you know, Randy DeFore, here's an email from Robert in Springfield. He says, people in Springfield have told Public Works and City Council about severe flooding roads at specific roads and intersections for more than a decade. When will they listen? So from Riverside down to Mandarin, Springfield, all across the community, people are asking for assistance. They are tired of flooded streets and wanting something to be done. And I know this is not news to you.
All right. I hear, you know, I'm a native of Jacksonville.
Right.
So I feel everyone's pain. And I think the reality is we've been doing a lot of Band-Aids. And it's time that we have a plan. And the good news is I think we're at a point where everyone's on the same page and we're going to get there. Now we're in the middle of a pandemic. So, you know, putting money, large chunks of money at this right this moment may not happen, but it will. But I assure you it's going to happen, and I believe, in the next couple of years. Hmm. But we got to get on the, again, we have to, this can't be fully funded by City of Jacksonville. It is too expensive. We're going to have to look for other funding, whether it be from the state or federal government. We're going to have to do our part to get in, you know, get on in that system, in those two systems, to get future funding.
That brings up a related question, Councilwoman. We are in the middle of hurricane season, and we are in the middle of a pandemic. Emergency preparedness experts have developed a new acronym for worst-case scenarios that could combine at the same time. They call it COVID-cane. Figuring out how to provide storm or hurricane relief in the middle of the COVID pandemic. That is primarily the federal response, but at the same time, I wanted to get your thoughts about that in case we do see that worst case scenario here in our area during hurricane season, trying to deal with people who have been devastated by a terrible hurricane at the same time that all of our local systems are stressed by dealing with the COVID pandemic. What are your thoughts about how we should be planning for that scenario?
Well, I can tell you that our emergency preparedness department here in Jacksonville is one of the best. I mean, and it's because, quite frankly, we've had to be dealing with the hurricanes one after another. So if we're looking at our city compared to other cities, I think we're in a very good position.
That's good to hear. And lots of calls flowing in for you now. Jeff in Mandarin. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I just wanted to ask a quick question to the council member. Mitigation, you've mentioned wetlands reclamation, but what are some of the other possible answers to that? Are artificial reefs and barriers that get put offshore? We have a mountain of used tires that have been used in lots of different places to build artificial reefs. Have we explored any of that, having some kind of a artificial reef or artificial barrier islands put outside our coast? It increases fishing, it increases sea life,
right?
It increases and mitigates some of the effect of some of the,
right,
the weather that comes through. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Jeff.
That is a great question. They have done that in Miami. This environmental planning group, I believe, is going to be looking at that as well. And we need to be looking at it not just from the coast perspective, but we also need to be looking at what can we do along the similar lines in terms of the river. There are things we can do, and we need to be looking at them.
549-2937, Dave in East Arlington. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Melissa. While we're debating how to spend billions of dollars and reacting to problems that were created out of ignorance, I'm a professional engineer and recognized these problems 25, 30 years ago. I think we should start thinking seriously about having a crash course in physics and remedial science for policymakers who are elected, because when you have science, when you have decision makers who don't frankly understand the forces that are causing these problems, they're never going to come up with solutions that address the root cause of the problem.
And are you referring to just the basic cause, meaning climate change, sea level rise,
basic
and
cause,
rising
cause
temperatures?
And
yeah.
Basic cause and effect for flooding. I mean, our water quality problems were identified 45 years ago, that it was nutrients from stormwater runoff that were going to pollute our surface waters and groundwaters, as well as point sources. 45 years ago, we now have elected officials who are trying to gut the Clean Water Act at the federal level, and at the state and local level, it's like, oh, you just kick the can down the road, and the problem will magically go away. We've seen this type of thinking even here with the COVID problem. You know, you kick the can down the road, it'll go away magically. There is no away. Policymakers have to understand basic science and then use science and facts to make policy decisions rather than just throw money at something and hope that it'll go away.
Thanks, Dave.
I mean, with our schools today, I read the paper this morning, we still don't have a rapid test that school officials can use to test people who might be infected, and yet we have a state mandate for kids going back to school regardless of the consequences.
I hear you, Dave. And I have two kids going back next week, so I completely agree with you on that. And I want to thank you for that. So,
this is political negligence.
Thank you, Dave. Council member DeFore, I would not include you in that group Dave mentions. I do think you have worked hard to educate yourself on the science behind these policy problems. But what about his overall anger that I think a lot of voters out there share, that there has been so much denial and foot dragging on this issue and on the pandemic response, too, as he noted, that by waiting so long to deal with this problem, it's going to end up costing us so much more than if we had been more proactive.
Yeah. Well, I share your frustration. Coming from the private sector, I can tell you government just does not work at the same pace. And I don't know a lot about, you know, I'm learning. I'm trying to learn as quickly as I can. But I think he's right. I mean, I think that we need to bring people in and give, you know, educate ourselves as to what we don't know. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, is the committee being advised by scientists and engineers?
Yes. In fact, we have engineers and scientists on these committees. I'll tell you this: we have the most well-educated community. Every time I go to these meetings, I am just blown away about the level of expertise we have in our community, and they're on these committees. And anybody out there that would like to participate, please do. It is open to the public, and we want that input.
That's right. And I would want to make a plug, if I could, as well, for our effort here at WJCT to raise awareness about these issues. It's our website, ADAPT. If you go to adaptflorida.org, you'll see a wealth of reporting that we have done that also curates reporting from across the state of Florida and even the nation, taking a deep dive into these issues and how they are expected to impact Florida in the coming years. And so before we wrap this up, you said, Councilmember DeFore, federal funding is going to be critical. You want input from the public. When is the next meeting of this committee, and how can people engage?
So tomorrow at 4, we have the Environmental Planning Committee is meeting. So if you'd like to join, please do. All this information is on the COJ.net website, and you can get it all there. Our next meeting in its entirety, which is for all the groups, will be August 28th at 2 o'clock. We're going to bring in Jim Murley. He's the Chief Resiliency Officer from Miami-Dade, and he's going to present to us. And we'd love you to join us.
Mark your calendars, people. She's Randy DeFore, the Resiliency Committee Chair on the Jacksonville City Council. Councilmember DeFore, thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a great day.
You too. Much more still ahead later in the hour. It's our book club as we focus on American Pastoral by Philip Roth. That's later. But up next.
Duval's supervisor hadn't sent anything out until about a week ago, and then it was just a postcard.
How accessible is voting by mail in our area? We'll hear from Mike Hogan, Supervisor of Elections, and other voting experts right after this.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
I am the fundraising manager here at the station. The best thing about my job is seeing the notes that come in with all these wonderful donations, talking about how a news story that we did really impacted them. Recently, I've seen a lot of donations come through with comments about us being so fair and balanced. They come to us because we're going to give them the truth. I'm Angel Dublin. This is WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World brings you more than just a day's news.
Well, the poor old British pub has been around for 2,000 years.
We introduce you to people around the globe.
I'm a Liberian, but I'm part of Africa.
If we were only in Argentina.
I think it's a Scottish thing, you know? This sense of doom there, but it's always kind of amusing to us.
Join us and hear The World. Weekday afternoons at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, in this time of pandemic, interest in voting by mail is way up as Florida voters request a mail-in or absentee ballot in large numbers. This primary election cycle, early voting is underway as we speak. You can vote by mail if you choose. Here in our area, Duval County's Supervisor of Elections has been criticized by some voter advocacy groups for not promoting mail-in balloting aggressively enough. We will hear from Election Supervisor Mike Hogan in just a few minutes. But first, here is an excerpt of my conversation about this with Brad Ashwell, the Florida State Director of All Voting is Local. Brad, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So you have been calling attention to the Duval County Supervisor of Elections Office, criticizing them for not sending vote-by-mail applications to voters in the county. Why is that standing out, I guess, in Florida right now?
Well, right now with COVID, voting by mail is the safest, from a health perspective, way to vote. And we've been really advocating for supervisors across the state to do what they can to make it more accessible to voters. A lot of other counties, a lot of other bigger counties like Duval, already sent out mail notifications, applications to vote by mail. They've done multiple advertisements, some counties multiple mailings, dating all the way back to spring. Yet we noticed that Duval's supervisor hadn't sent anything out until about a week ago, and then it was just a postcard. So we're concerned about this. We really think he needs to do everything he can to make voting by mail accessible, especially right now given COVID.
How does Duval County compare to other large Florida metros when it comes to alerting voters about this?
Well, in Orange County, they send vote-by-mail notifications to every registered voter, letting them know if they had a standing request and how to order a ballot if they didn't. They also sent out emails. They ran radio and print advertisements. Broward County sent vote-by-mail applications to 1 million registered voters in their county, with an increase of 100,000 voters with vote-by-mail ballot requests. Hillsborough also sent out about 600,000 vote-by-mail applications to their registered voters back in spring. So we're seeing a lot of other counties really step up to the need, and we aren't seeing that in Duval, and it's deeply concerning.
Now, you're saying that they did send out a postcard to residents, so it's not as though they've done nothing, but you're saying you believe they could do more. Is that right?
Well, right. It's kind of too little and too late. He didn't send out anything until about a week ago. Like I said, some of these other counties have been sending out one, maybe two mailings and you know, since the spring. So we're early voting's already started. There's still time for voters to request their vote by mail ballots. It's probably too late for them to send a mailing now. But, you know, it really isn't enough, and we need to see him do more for the general.
All right, that was Brad Ashwell from All Voting is Local. Mike Hogan, the Duval County Supervisor of Elections, disputes this criticism of his office. He says he has been proactive about getting mail-in balloting information out to the voters. Here is what Hogan has to say. Mike Hogan, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good to talk with you, Melissa. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. So early voting underway. How is it going?
Well, we just finished a full week of it and started out really good. Currently, turnout is about almost 8.7%. So it's been, pretty uneventful, except we have had a large increase in mail ballots.
And I'm glad to get this information from you because we did get an outreach from a group called All Voting is Local. And they and they compared Duval County to Broward, Hillsborough, Orange, and Pinellas counties in Florida, saying that in their view, you should have made notifications about mail-in balloting sooner and made it easier with fewer steps for people to get an absentee or vote by mail ballot. What's your response to that?
Well, we actually did. We sent the mailer out. I get every single email that comes into this office, even during the election cycle, and I'm up till midnight answering questions or responding. And I've not heard any constituent say that they can't get to us or they don't have enough notice, they don't understand, because we work with everybody. And you can't compare one county to another in the state of Florida. It's impossible to do. From size to wealth to operational, there is a whole host of things that, if you want to just look at and pick things out. For instance, we're one of the few, some have picked it up this year, but we're one of the few counties that pay for return postage. If you're going to make comparisons, you'd have to look at the whole picture.
Okay. So do you feel then that they are unfairly singling out the Duval SOE?
I don't care what those organizations say or think. What I care is how we produce and how our constituents and our voters view us. Not a third party that is, we've seen a lot of their letters. Their information is incorrect that they're sending to voters. One is coming out recently, saying, you only have 7 days of early voting. We don't have only 7 days of early voting. We have 14 days of early voting. And they're using stuff to attack all the supervisors, and they're using the very limited data, and they're not asking questions up front.
Supervisor Mike Hogan. Again, a reminder, early voting is underway now for the primary election next Tuesday. It's still not too late if you hurry to request a mail-in ballot either online or over the phone. Well, this month's First Coast Connect Book Club selection is a timely one. American Pastoral by Philip Roth. Our intrepid book club leader, Stacy Goldring, has chosen this for all of you dear readers, and she's on the line with more about why. Hi, Stacy.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. It's so good to have you on the show and hear your voice. The theme of American Pastoral is nostalgia versus reality. So maybe some timely implications for today?
You hit the nail on the head. This book is, if anything, incredibly timely. This is another example, Melissa, of reading literature as a tool to understanding the present. And this is what Philip Roth does for us. I'm fascinated with Roth. And if you have PTSD like I do from reading Goodbye Columbus and Portnoy's Complaint, I suggest that you put those aside and take a big, deep breath and realize that we all grow up. He wrote those books in his 20s, and I don't know about you, but I don't want to revisit my 20s. American Pastoral is part of what's considered his American trilogy, and I would say it's probably one of his best works. And it basically takes a look at three generations of family and what happens. Well, let's just put it this way. I say to people, wasn't this a lovely book on being a good parent? Because this definitely exposes what it's like to be a parent. It exposes what it's like to grow up and want to meet everyone's expectations. And what happens when those expectations fail, whether it's your expectation for being an American or a father or a husband, a businessman, you name it, what it's like to be a man in the United States growing up post-World War II and growing up in the 50s, the nostalgic 50s, and then becoming a parent in the 70s with the SDS, Vietnam, the Weather Underground, protests. I don't know if anything sounds familiar,
right.
But it should. It's an absolutely remarkable, strong read.
What made you hit upon this book at this particular time?
I work with an amazing partner who helps me select books. Her name is Randy, and Randy and I decided to bring Roth back. We thought it was time. Several years ago, we read Plot Against America, and we thought it was time again for Roth, although all the books that I bring to you have been voted on with no dangling chads by members of our chapter and notes book clubs. And you know, Melissa, these things just happen in literature all the time. You'll be reading something and you'll think, oh my goodness, this author is so prescient. But this is what literature does. It opens up your mind to understand that what's happening now on the news has happened before. And you bring a sense of perspective to all the crazy that's going on now when you have something like American Pastoral to kind of have in your first aid toolkit when you listen to the news or read the paper, whatever it is. And I suggest that everyone read this book, regardless of whether you have to gird your loins before you open that first page and dive in, because Roth's writing is so refined yet so incredibly raw, you're going to have to take a breath.
Hmm.
You're going to have to step back. You're going to have to say, did I just read that?
Hmm.
And it all takes place with the main character who's nicknamed the Swede, who is the all-American boy, the perfect son, the perfect father, the perfect businessman. And you know what? Life happens. And what happens when it doesn't work out? And this is real life. This is what we all have to deal with. We have to look in the mirror and say, well, whoa, that didn't go as I planned. And now what does it all mean? But man, it's a book you either want to throw at the wall with great force or hide from, or
we want to throw a lot of things at the wall with great force right now, don't we? You know, books are such a comfort in this time, and book sales are way up, particularly digitally, because people are home more and they are reflecting more. And so, and as we talk to you about our monthly book club, you can always connect with Stacy by emailing her at bookclub@wjct.org. And as we talk about American Pastoral, I know that you have a book on your list for next month, and you're going to have an online discussion for it, which we are doing now for all of your books now that we cannot all meet in person. How are these online discussions going?
They're absolutely fascinating, and I've decided to make it a permanent part of our reading experience, Melissa. So I will have anyone can join Chapter End Notes online. You just have to go to facebook.com/chapterendnotes to sign up, and we will continue these discussions. And luckily, we have more time when we're meeting via Zoom. And so our discussions go very deep, and you know, I just learned so much. Whether I love the book or hated it, I don't even care. And I don't even care if people read the book or not, because the idea is that we come together, and I feel the books that we discussed are springboards for understanding one another better. And that's what book discussions do. And now that we will be also in person and now online as well, we'll have an opportunity to do that regardless of the virus, regardless of where you live, time zone, et cetera. And next month we'll be discussing, actually in September, we'll be discussing Manhunt, which is a fabulous, fabulous nonfiction, because we'll read anything. And it is about the 12-day chase for Lincoln's killer. And it is a fabulous, it's the page turner, wonderfully written by James L. Swanson. That's Manhunt. James L. Swanson, and that's what we'll be reading next month and discussing together.
All right, and then this month, the recommendation for our book club is American Pastoral by Philip Roth. And as I said, you can contact Stacy with book club suggestions, figure out how to connect with her virtual book club by emailing her at bookclub@wjct.org or find her on Facebook. It's Chapter End Notes. And I see you've been traveling. Before I let you go, Stacey, I've been following you on social media. You've been traveling a little bit and visiting some famous bookstores. Is that right?
I've been virtually traveling.
Traveling
from my tush on my sofa.
Okay.
I have traveled. I've been very fortunate to travel, and I always try to visit bookstores and libraries. That's what a nerd your friend Stacy is, wherever I go. And so I've been posting some, I've been waxing poetic and hoping to revisit one day beautiful bookstores and libraries and, you know, Dublin and in Amsterdam and, Jackson, but wherever I can go, because if we can't physically be there, thanks to social media, and I never thought I'd say that, but thanks to social media, I'm very grateful that at least I can share these beautiful images with other people who love books.
Yes. So follow Stacy on social media and drop her an email at bookclub@wjct.org. Great to hear your voice, and enjoy your reading. Thank you so much.
And you know what? We really appreciate everything you're doing as a journalist. I'm taking the liberty to speak on behalf of everyone and just say, mwah, and keep at it. We're so appreciative for journalism, good journalism.
Thank you. We are all here at the station working hard on that. And in a moment, how two local companies are breaking down stereotypes to get more kids of color surfing. We'll be right back. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Don't go away.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
Baltimore has more than 16,000 buildings on its vacancy list, a crisis economically and socially. But for one builder on one block, those vacancies are an opportunity.
I'm going to rebuild this block. We're going to do 10 houses, and we're going to make 10 women, 10 black women homeowners.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the first of those 10 houses, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, political strategist Stuart Stevens. He spent decades helping elect Republicans. Now he's working to defeat President Trump. In his new book, It Was All a Lie, he condemns party leaders for what he says is their cowardly support of a man they know is unfit to lead the country. Join us.
Today at noon, here on WJCT News 89.9.
In the race to find a COVID vaccine, we've asked where it might come from, when we might get one, and who will get it first. But perhaps the question that matters most is, how much is it going to cost?
We have to care about fairness and about access, even when people can't afford the drug.
I'm Jen White. How do we price a vaccine? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, two local companies, Enact and Surfer Negra, are teaming up to break stigmas and stereotypes that prevent people of color from being connected to the water. Together with award-winning photographer Malcolm Jackson, these companies have created a limited edition tote bag that pays homage to the Black Lives Matter movement. They want to empower and inspire especially young girls of color to do things they maybe didn't think were possible, both in and out of the surf industry. Plus, proceeds from the sale of the bag will be used to send young girls to surf camps and have a chance to fall in love with the sport and the lifestyle. Now, not only is this campaign working to diversify surf lineups and grow the sport leading up to surfing's first Olympics, yes, that's coming, but they're also helping to promote environmentally conscious design. The tote bag is made of sustainable plant fibers, and the campaign is highlighting the benefits of fibers such as hemp. Each bag you buy saves 236 days of drinking water. I learned more about this from Brianna Kilcullen. She is the founder of Enact. Brianna, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So you have worked together with an award-winning photographer and another company to create a new product that pays homage to the Black Lives Matter movement and particularly young girls of color. What are you working on?
Right. So we created a tote bag made out of hemp and organic cotton that we had printed here. And the photo is a photo shot by Malcolm Jackson on American Beach. That was a part of the Black Beach collection that they had earlier this year. And the photos of Gigi Lucas, who's the founder of Surfer Negra, which is a nonprofit based here in Jacksonville that gets young girls of color to learn how to surf. And so we teamed up a couple of months ago, and we were already planning to work together. But then after the death of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement being reignited, we really wanted to give people an opportunity to vote with their dollar and to wear their values. And so we're sending 10% of sales go towards Surfer Negra and getting young girls around the country, but especially here in Jacksonville, to learn how to surf because there's a lot of aquatic inequality. And so we felt like that was a way that we could help do something here in the community.
Right. You want to break stigmas and stereotypes that prevent people of color, especially young girls, from getting connected to the water and the ocean.
Right. And I think personally, I felt like that was really powerful because, you know, when we were protesting, there's so many ways of civil disobedience and that you can show your activism. And I felt like that we were missing this additional piece of how do we create and look to the future and help remove those barriers of entry so that we can have a more equal and just society. And it felt like this was a perfect opportunity. And there's the surf industry is so heavily male dominated, and then added it's so heavily white male dominated that it was a no-brainer. And especially with COVID, being able to support initiative that's getting people in the water, and there's so many healing properties that come with that, is just something that really felt synergistic in bringing it all together.
check it out at enact.com or at surfernegra.com. This is a great initiative. Brianna, thank you so much for letting us know about it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on to share about it.
Again, that limited edition tote bag is at enact.com. That's A-N-A-C-T.com, a joint of Enact and another local company, Surfer Negra. This is such a great idea, and it really not only supports the environment, it helps remedy historic inequities that have prevented children of color from having access to swimming in the ocean. So check it out. And if you want some more good news, you're going to want to sign up for our What's Good Wednesday newsletter. Every week for free, we drop it right into your inbox, some fresh, sparkling midweek updates that we curate just for you. Some positive news in this time of pandemic and recession, because goodness knows we all need it. You can sign up for What's Good Wednesdays at WJCT.org. Just look for the sign up right there on the homepage. And if you have some good news you'd like us to put on our weekly menu, let us know. Email us at firstcoastconnect@WJCT.org. And we will see if we can fit it in because already we're hearing from so many of you out there about people or organizations you want to give a shout out to, because people are doing everything they can right now to help others. And we all need to try to focus on that. And that is our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield runs our digital. Keep those emails coming, as I said, always to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything from today's show, you can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock or our podcast up later today. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Have a wonderful day, and everyone, keep the masks on.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.